Well,
thank you.
Yeah, I'll give you a 5 minute lecture.
Okay. I'm an alcoholic. My name is John.
We love you, John.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. That's a YPA thing, and for those of you who don't know what that means, that's young people in AA in the U.S. We chant things, we're obnoxious during how it works, and we're really excited for recovery. So that's what that was. So I'm gonna be very brief on my story when it comes to what it was like. I'm not a very traditional speaker in the sense that I don't come from a broken family. I'm pretty blessed. My parents have been married for 37 years, and I'm a firm believer that my alcoholism centers in my brain and my heart, in the manifestations of I'm not good enough, I don't amount to this, and I don't amount to that. And it keeps me a prisoner as long as I don't use the tools and resources that I learned in this program. So So just briefly, I grew up in New Jersey, and ever since I was a young kid, I was quite sensitive. I always wanted the best for everybody. I was their cheerleader. I just wanted to make people happy any way that I could. And I didn't understand when people would be mean or cruel, and it pretty much tore me apart growing up. I was picked last on the sports teams, and I just feel like I never really fit in, and there was nowhere for me to exist. I grew up in a very upper middle class neighborhood. There we are. So privilege was a big part of my upbringing. We never had to worry about anything. And the older I got, the tougher it got, the meaner the kids were in school. And I just remember fantasizing about living in a different world at a different time. And I just felt like it just didn't make sense for me to be there, because how could I practice so much compassion to these people and get this response of hostility and not fitting in? So, I noticed that there was definitely something different about me, and then I didn't feel like I could identify with the other kids. And then one night when I was 16 years old, I was drinking with my best friend. When I discovered vodka, that's when I started drinking at 16. And what happened was I drank a bottle of Smirnoff and had about 8 shots of tequila in the middle of that. The next thing I knew, she lived 4 houses down from my house, and we ended up in her parents' basement, covered in vomit. There was a dog. The dog had vomit all over it, and then there was a carpet from Africa that was like $3,000, and that carpet was destroyed with lots of vomit. So my parents came down the stairs, because one of the flashbacks was me seeing them coming down the stairs to this site of drunken intoxication and pandemonium, and the next thing I knew, this best friend is vomiting, and as she's vomiting, she says, "Your son is gay, and he's a homosexual." And I was like, "Oh, great!" Like, so that is my coming out story. That is how I came out of the closet. Yeah. And so that set the stage for what was going to happen. And my parents are extremely conservative. They're very, very conservative. They thought it was a phase, and I was like, oh, great, another group of people very, very close to me that don't understand and accept me. So let's continue this story. So I then took comfort in choosing to hang out with people from other, how could you say, like high schools, and I started taking the train into New York City. I got my first fake ID when I was 17 years old, and boom, there was a New Jersey Transit train that took you all the way from New Jersey and all the way to New York City. I memorized the subway system, got alcohol, and then I soon graduated high school and networked my way into community college. So I failed out of community college, which was the first school, and then I barely graduated because I was drinking so heavily. That I think I got into a school in Florida just by like the skin of my teeth. And when I got into this school, the drinking and the craziness was still such a problem in my life that I didn't even make it through the first semester. I got all failing grades, but before the grades could come in, I withdrew entirely from the university. And I met and surrounded myself with people who could only drink as much as I could. So I only wanted to be around somebody who did not get sick, because if you were throwing up, that meant that I had to either take care of you, hold your hair back, and like I had a bottle of vodka next to the toilet and I was still drinking that vodka while you were throwing up. And I was very very inconvenienced. So I only wanted to be around the pretty people, and I gathered them up, and I had this social ability of human connection and networking, and I thought that I was using these powers for the greater good. I would get people together, and we would just go out and party, and we had VIP in Florida, Miami, and New York City, and I thought I was famous. And this egoic insanity just started to drive me of like, wow, I want more and more and more and more, right? But like, none of this was ever really enough. So the next thing I knew, I'm airlined home, and I'm upside down drunk on a rope swing, you know, like those things that you just run and get a running start. There was a cliff. I live on a family farm in New Jersey, and I got this running start. I was showing off for my friends, and I hang upside down with my head this far away from the ground. And the next thing I knew, we had this rope since I was a kid, so it was like 20 years old. The knot came off at 15 feet up in the air, and I fell onto the frozen rocky ground and triple fractured my pelvis. They had to put me on the stretcher on my stomach, and I was like, great, I don't even know what's going on. I never thought I was gonna walk again, so I was on a walker for like a month and a half. And I didn't really know what to do with myself, and so my parents airlined me back to Florida, where I stayed for about a day and a half at my grandmother's house, where I could use the pool and rehabilitate. And the next thing I knew, I was a bottle of vodka in. So I drank an entire 750 milliliters of Ketel One vodka, and invited my old party buddy from that Miami university. And he came up, and we pretended that we were sleeping, so my grandmother thought that we were asleep. And we snuck out of the back door, got in his car, and he was the designated drunk driver, right? So we ended up bar hopping from bar to bar, and the next thing I knew, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, we see flashing lights, there's a bottle of vodka under my seat, and he gets pulled over, and that was his DWI. And the next thing I knew, I didn't know what to do, so the cop put me in a taxi cab, and I went back to my grandmother's house. She's 80 years old. I was banging on her hurricane shutters. She's like, I thought you were sleeping. What's going on? She thought she was getting robbed. And I looked at her, and I don't remember saying this at all, but I looked at her, and what I said was, Adam's in jail, and when I start drinking, there's nothing that I can do to stop, and I need help. I don't remember saying that, ever. So I fell asleep and passed out on her floor in the hallway, and woke up to a phone call from my dad and her waking me up saying, you're going home right now, you're on the next flight home, like you're done. So I was just totally mortified, and I literally had no idea what to do. The minute that my mother would not look at me was the minute that I knew like this whole lifestyle was not gonna end well. I was close to death. I was drinking a bottle of vodka every single time I drank, and I'm not one of those alcoholics that had to drink every day. I could actually go 2 weeks without drinking, but the minute I put that first shot of vodka into my body, like the whole bottle's gone, and I have anxiety that there's not a second bottle ready for me. So I kind of pulled a memory back where I was like, in like junior college, I studied sociology, and for a project, we had to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I went to this meeting, I realized that these people were hugging each other, and I was like, hi, I'm here to study you people. If I can like write a book report on you, that's cool. So I did this little book report, and that triggered a memory that planted that seed that I knew that I had a safe place to go to when stuff got bad enough, right? So I showed up to my first meeting. It was 10 50-year-old men bikers who scared the crap out of me, and they told me that they were really glad that I was there, and I was like, uh-oh. And I thought it was a cult, and I thought I was gonna die, but they said keep coming back. So I showed up again, and I got a home group, and then I got a sponsor, and then they told me to get a coffee commitment, and I was still scared of people because I couldn't even show up to a movie theater without drinking alcohol in the parking lot. So I was like, oh, I have to go greet all these people now? Like, this is terrifying. So I started getting these commitments, and day 30, this really tough chick comes up to me, and she's like, yo, you're new. You know, you're from Jersey, I'm from Jersey, I'm sober, you're sober. There's a conference going on, like, it's gonna change your life. And I was like, whatever. And I was like, well, I'm pretty much grounded. My parents don't let me use my car, and I have nothing else to do, so sure. So I went to my very first conference called Garden State Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was at this scenic lake with like little cabins, and my dad gave me $250 for the weekend to go because he felt sorry for me, not knowing that this was going to transform my entire life. So I show up to this place, and there's all these like young people and a mixture of like other people, and it was just lots of diversity. And these people were so happy and excited, and there were workshops, and I got surrounded by other people who wanted to take me through the conference experience. They were like, all right, this is what we're gonna do. Just follow me around. We'll go to workshops together. Like, we want to hang out with you. And I was like, wow. Because I, of course, was never really invited to parties. I had to create the parties at my own hotel room and supply my own alcohol so that people would come. And now these people don't even need me to have alcohol on me, and they want to hang out with me. I'm like, this is great. So I saw people dancing for the first time without being intoxicated, very similar to what we did last night. My voice is still cracking because I was dancing with Casey until 2 o'clock in the morning, and we were having such a good time. But anyways, this conference was the beginning of such an exciting life, and I didn't tell anybody this, but since I had failed out of pretty much both of those colleges, when I started to do my step work, when it came to the ninth step amends, I went to the head of the university community college. We call them junior colleges in the US. And I made this amends and said, hey, I'm really sorry. I was drinking all the time while I was in your program. And is there anything that I can do to make it better? I've got like this much sobriety. And she said, John, I'm so excited for you. You've been shining a light this entire time, but you have not realized your true potential. I'm going to write you a letter of recommendation to the college of your choice. So she writes this letter of recommendation. I have like these mediocre grades. And the next thing I know, I go to another conference, and my sister calls me while I'm at this AA conference. And she's like, John, why didn't you tell us? I just opened up your mail, and you just got accepted to Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, which is like the top aeronautical school pretty much in the world. And I was like blown away, and I had no idea how to pay for it, and I hadn't gone through all of my steps yet. So I deferred an extra semester, which was the most important decision I ever made, because I was able to go through all the steps, build a solid foundation, and before going out to Arizona and making that major geographical, I was ready, and I had the tools, and I had full loans, so I didn't really know how to pay this off. I didn't know how I was going to get approved for these things, and the next thing I knew, I found a home group in Arizona, and when I was there, I got involved on campus. I brought recovery to the school, and I merged a relationship with some young people organizations so that students were taken care of, and I got to fly out to Dubai for an aviation conference. And when I was in Dubai, there's a global email like subscription that I send an email to when I'm traveling. And it's like, hey, John is a college student from Arizona and he's gonna be in Dubai. If anybody can be of service, please send him a message and I'll connect you or blah, blah, blah. So I get picked up at my hotel about an hour after the airplane lands by a fellow in AA who has an AA cell phone in the United Arab Emirates. He takes me to a coffee shop, gives me an entire downtown tour of Dubai, and then takes me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I arrived at this meeting, there were people from 6 out of the 7 continents of the world there sharing their different stories, and I was so jet lagged that I was emotional and so just so filled with gratitude. And these stories just popped up everywhere. Before I graduated, the semester before I graduated, I had gotten so involved in service work that I received $107,000 in scholarships and graduated debt-free early, which to me was a pretty big deal because I'm a double college dropout who didn't really have that much self-esteem. So yesterday we got to lead a workshop on step 6 and 7, and it was really exciting talking about the character defects. And at the end of it, so we acted out, we did some improv where I invited somebody up to act out what character defects look like so we can identify them. And And then after that, we took a walk downstairs and crossed the road and said the wee version of the Serenity Prayer and screamed, "Drop the rock," and threw our character defects with our little rocks written in into the ocean, representing that release of that, or the desire to continue building an awareness of that internal freedom. So something that I have been consciously working on in the past couple years is how my alcoholism will manifest in my present day sobriety. So something that I'm really grateful for is the ability to do service work. And I feel like every single time I default to loneliness, which is like that core of not enoughness and like the middle of that donut that keeps me in fear and keeps me so far away from love. Every single time I show up for another person in this program, whether it's a coffee commitment or leading a meeting or going to a convention, right? This is like, it's like a physical effect of medicine that has on my body, where I leave immediately filled with joy, gratitude, and bliss. And I just wish that I could spread this message a little bit more, and I do as much as I can. But for so many years, I thought that I had to numb myself with alcohol and drugs, and that that was the only solution to connect me to other people. And I no longer owe anybody anything except showing up for myself and showing up for them. And I feel like the more I take care of myself, the more I'm taking care of other people. So pretty grateful to be here. I wanted to also touch on another fact. After I graduated this university, I failed at something. And this is really important because I was on this pink cloud. I graduated debt-free. I was at the top of my class, and they recognized me in front of all of the people in the graduation ceremony after they commissioned the United States Navy and Army. And it was like this really cool community service award that I got for the impact that I had on the community. So I took this job in New York City that was a miserable desk job, and I was there. And it was exhausting. I had to wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning and take an hour and a half bus each way in rush hour traffic. And I hated it. I didn't want to be there. And I asked my higher power for them to fire me because I was too afraid to let them down. And I was too afraid to have my family know that I gave this thing my big shot after being like on top of the pyramid for so long. And finally, I had a 7 a.m. home group. On 46th Street in New York City. And I asked somebody in the program, and I was like, oh, like, what are these people at this company gonna think of me? I'm this energetic, happy guy who like sucks at this computer job, and I don't really know what to do. And he's like, John, if you ask people in AA, or if you ask people anywhere what they're thinking about, 99% of the time, it is about themselves. So like, don't worry about you, like clean up your side of the street, leave that miserable situation, and like greener things will come to you. So this was around the time where I got like this rush of like this great higher power energy over me, and I was feeling really grateful for being sober and grateful for that home group that kept me sane in that terrible job. So I compiled a list of pictures of the things and the accomplishments that I had done since I've gotten sober. The Dubai trip, the scholarships, the conventions. I've made photocopies of the pictures of my coins in AA and all of my conference badges, and I put them in a scrapbook album, and I sent them, not thinking that anything was gonna happen, I sent them to the police officer who pulled over my friend and gave him that DWI back in Florida. So I'm like at this miserable job, I'm like ready to quit, and I get this voicemail from my phone because I was in the elevator and I missed the call. And it's like, hi, this is Rachel calling from Channel 5 News. We received your scrapbook and your story from Officer Daniel Dillard in West Palm Beach, Florida. And I was like, wait, what? So I call her back and she's like, yeah, and we want to feature your story. Of course, we're going to respect the anonymity, but we want to feature the story about the scrapbook and how this officer and this police officer has cleared off all of the awards and put them in his cabinets, so that he could put your scrapbook on top of his desk and feature that, because that was more meaningful and impactful than anything that he has ever done, right? I was like, whoa. So I did a quick Skype interview, thanked him, talked about the impact of how this officer has pretty much changed my life, and I'm pretty grateful for that. So after failing at this job, I got this really cool job recruiting airline pilots, and because I was able to have this freedom of flexibility and travel, I I hopped on flights for free, and I got to go to meetings in 33 states in the United States, as well as 8 countries. And the more I continued to go to these meetings, the more service opportunities popped up. And I had the opportunity to go speak at, or not speak, but lead a workshop at Skankipa, which was in Norway, and we rang in the new year. It was a lot of fun. And because of that, I followed my amazing German friends back to Germany, and they let me speak at their home group, which, small world, that happens. And then this came up, and it's just really, really humbling. The last thing that I want to touch on is vulnerability and shame. So this is really, really tough when we talk. Am I 5 minutes? Still good? Okay. So something that has really crept up on me, and that we talked about this during the Step 6 and 7 workshop, is shame. So remember, I was that kid that like was never picked, and now I have this really awesome life where I'm recruiting and I have fun, positive impacts on people, and I like being of service. But at the end of the day, there's still times where I feel like I'm in this super crowded room and I'm all alone and I don't fit in and there's no place for me. And that's my disease of alcoholism telling me that not enoughness needs to come out, right? So shame, the way that I like to describe shame is that there's a huge difference between guilt and shame. So guilt is I did something bad, and shame is I am bad, right? So to me, shame is pent up energy, and it's trapped energy that's stored in the body, and it's not expelled, and it's not gotten rid of until we take these conscious attempts to practice, say, humility and principles that we have learned in this program. So the opposite of the defect is the cure to my shame, right? So when I feel lonely, I choose to replace that with fellowship. So I get a coffee commitment, I show up, I give another alcoholic a call, and it's that like immediate gratitude and that bliss that comes back, and it's like, wow, I was gonna sit in my room and I was gonna self-sabotage and I was gonna think that nobody called me, and then that since I did all the work and I got no responses, that I might as well sit in self-pity. Well, that's not the case anymore. So I feel like tackling this shame aspect has been really freeing and healing. I've recently come into contact with some people that have really been healing my shame journey. So something that I was told very early on was, saying yes and meaning no is very dangerous. I went to a workshop at another convention on saying yes and meaning no. So when we sign up for things and we sign up for people, at least in my experience, that are not in alignment with our highest selves, it is emotionally and physically draining to not only be in their company, like if they're not going to share the desire to like get better or transform or do things that are going to make both of us better, then it's exhausting. And for so many years, I surrounded myself with those exact people, thinking that I could change them, thinking that I could develop camaraderie with them. And I feel like the real definition of fellowship that is helping me overcome this shame is the real sense of community that we all have here. So the more I continue to get involved, the more miracles start to happen. A few people that I came into the program with, the young people, I guess you could call them, are no longer sober with me. So it's been really, really challenging to continue kind of trudging along when the guy who introduced me to the powdered forms of alcohol is now dead. So yeah, I spent a lot of time with him in college, and the fact that he's no longer there is very, like, very sobering. But the question to me is, like, I get to keep living this life and I get to keep carrying this message, so I'm going to continue doing that. Let's see, the very last thing that I want to touch on is going to be vulnerability. So vulnerability is defined as emotional risk, exposure, and being seen for who you really are, right? This past year has been really interesting in the vulnerability component because my alcoholism snuck up on me so crazily that it manifested in the form of like my body is not good enough. Mind you, I wake up at 5:30 a.m. before I go into work. I have this amazing workout. I'm always carrying protein at work, and people make fun of me because I have this giant jug of protein with a shaker at all times. And every time I'm around at a pool, people compliment me on my physical body, and they say great things about me, but that not enoughness has come back in year five, right? And that vulnerability component has been really, really fascinating. We talked about like practicing the principles to oppose the defects. So I joined a few things. I recently just got a job for a big tech company in Austin, Texas, and made this big move. And there's a whole community of recovery and a whole community of wellness attached to this really cool Austin place. There's a lake that's really scenic. It looks like the Mediterranean Sea. And I go to this lake and I read a book and I'm really content being alone. So I also show up in person and have the ability to share my life with other people in a very honest and compassionate way. 5 minutes, less than five? Cool. So practicing vulnerability, and even at work, telling these coworkers that I'm struggling, telling my manager, hey, like, I don't know where I stand right now. Can I please have some honest feedback on like what I can do to improve myself? Has really, instead of allowing me to suffer silently, I'm so used to like that self-sabotage of like, ah, screw it. Like, I'm just gonna give up on this, I'm gonna quit. But now, practicing vulnerability and saying, hey, I don't know, is like the most powerful thing that I can do in my recovery. Like saying I don't know not only empowers other people to help me, and then they feel like they just did something really cool, but I get an answer and a solution out of that, so that's awesome too. Yeah, so I'm pretty grateful. I turned six on March 16th. I got sober when I was 23 years old, and I encourage everybody to leave this conference. I know the workshops have been phenomenal, and thank you so much to the committee for organizing this and all of your service work and having so much fun. But I encourage everybody to take a deeper look at what's really going on inside. I want to read this tiny little email that I got from a fellow in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I feel like this is really, really important to notice. So there was an old timer who had 20 years of sobriety, showed up to all these meetings, gave all this advice, you should do this, you should do this, and you should do this. This guy was suffering inside because he chose not to take care of his character defects, and I want to read you the story of what actually happened to him. Are we cool with that? It's really short, at least I think. So it's called, the subject liner that I got one morning recently, like 3 weeks ago, was "We buried him today." So it says, "We buried him today. The county coroner had published the required notices for the next of kin and nobody had claimed the body. It was just myself and his sponsor, no preacher even. The county does not pay for those. Not much of a send-off and not one that David had asked for. A cheap coffin, a backhoe dug a hole, and that was it, another old AA gone. He had been sober for over 20 years in AA, over 30, a stern and rigid man who tried to soften his edges and never could. He was a loner, a fringer, an isolated man at the edge of life's good things. He hung in there, and at the end, he hung himself. I don't know why, I can't know. I know that there had been a diagnosis of senile dementia, and I know that the doctor had added cancer to the list, but as I've seen AAs deal with such things before, I don't know why David decided that he could no longer do it. This is not the first time that I've been through this in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've known several over the years who just up and walked out life's door one day. Sober, but not happy. Sober, but not at peace. Sober, but they died of alcoholism. Our disease does not need us to drink in order to kill us. I wish more folks knew that and appreciated it. Alcoholism is the only disease that is entirely capable of fighting back, of taking care of itself, and of emerging in new places and new forms when it's not properly treated. That is because of the spiritual malady. Most people think that has something to do with the prayer or God. It does not. It has to do with our spirit, that force that animates, motivates, and propels us. As an alcoholic, my spirit is ill. It is flawed. My character or basic nature does not work right. And at its root, it's a fundamental and unresolvable insecurity, a hole that can never be filled. It is an instinct run rampant, a desperate need for acceptance and love that cannot be met. It hurts. It fills one with fear. The selfishness and self-centeredness of the alcoholic lies here. We are totally preoccupied with what is going on ourselves on the inside. The slings and arrows of experience warped by this need to drives us to the fringe, and the voices of that shitty committee someone mentioned earlier in our head keep us there. We are obsessed with ourselves, and from this condition of mind, the insanity of feelings gone haywire, we become self-medicators eventually. We discover alcohol or something else, and that stuff quiets the voices, provides the relief that we have never been able to find in any other way. It is not any wonder why we drink or drug the way that we do. And some of us do not develop an addiction in attempting to meet these crying demands of our spirit, becoming ill. We develop other malformations of behavior and suffer in 100 different ways. God broke David's obsession to drink, but I don't think David ever truly understood his disease. I say that because I watched him struggle with those old unresolved issues of his heart for years. His rigidity, coldness, aloofness, isolation, and difficulty with other people were a reflection of the pain in his heart, of the disease of alcoholism gone deep inside and still active. Alcoholism did not need David to drink in order to continue trying to kill him, and in the end, it actually succeeded. In the end, instead of self-abandonment, David abandoned hope and discovered a very bitter end. Our recovery from alcoholism through the steps must be a threefold process. It is not one-dimensional. When we say in AA that we have a circle and triangle, recovery, unity, and service, we mean it. In working the steps, I clear a pathway for two purposes. First, to come into the group of human people and away from the fringe of society where I have spent most of my emotional life. Secondly, to discover that belonging through service to the people within the group. It is only this entire threefold process that heals. It is especially true for those who suffer from the spiritual malady to a great degree. Perhaps the 12th step says it best. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, which is recovery, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics, which is service, and to practice these principles in all our affairs, which is unity. That's all I'm going to read there, but I feel like that was pretty important to say because I've seen some old timers and some other people really struggling with this stuff. I'm going to end on this one quote, and I don't use profanity during my shares, but I'm going to use some borderline profanity in this because this quote really, really helps me out. So, and the message behind it is that when I'm uncomfortable, I need to sit in the discomfort and I need to walk into it and honor it, see the pain, see the struggle, and be like, wow, you're there? All right, I am literally headed this way and I'm going to be practicing all these awesome principles. So the quote from this old timer that I heard in my first year in my home group was, the shit you step in today is the fertilizer for tomorrow's growth. Thank you guys.